What is Wisconsin shipping across the continent and overseas? It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and for Kate Archer Kent. And the short answer is a lot more than we used to. Value of exports from Wisconsin continues to grow as demand for our goods expands around the globe, and it's far from just beer and cheese. So what do you want to know about Wisconsin's role in international markets? And what do you think the future holds for Wisconsin's producers and manufacturers? 1-800-642-1234 to join our conversation or email ideas at WPR.org. Our guest this morning, Katie Sinnott. She's the Vice President of Global Trade and Investment for the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. Katie, good morning.
Good morning, Lee. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate you being here because I think I start looking at the numbers and it's hard to wrap your head around. And then you start thinking about, well, what's Wisconsin known for? And then you look at some of the details of some of the products that we've been exporting. And it may not be what you think. But let's begin with the countries that are our top trading partners here in Wisconsin, exports and imports. Katie, what do you see?
Sure. I'd love to talk about that. Our top three destinations are Canada, Mexico, and China, and Germany rounds out the bottom. When you look at Canada, we have exports of about $7.5 billion, and we saw significant gains in that area, pushing total export levels to levels we haven't seen since 2014. In Mexico, we maintained the second largest export destination with exports of $3.1 billion. And the global pandemic significantly impacted Wisconsin's exports to Mexico, with pharmaceutical exports dramatically increasing by almost 3,000%. And we saw that in many countries. And China really increased their purchases as well, with $1.8 billion worth of Wisconsin goods, increase of 16%, with medical and scientific instruments and pharmaceutical exports growing by 23%. And 164%, respectively. Again, those pharmaceuticals products are increasing in great numbers. And then Germany rounded out the bottom as our top export destination within Europe.
And Katie, overall, what was our dollar figure on our pharmaceutical exports from Wisconsin in 2021?
So pharmaceuticals grew by a significant amount. It was over 60%. And, you know, a lot of that obviously had to do with COVID, and the actual amount was $1.9 billion. Sorry, the increase was 514%.
Wow.
So huge amount. We went from exporting almost nothing to increasing by about $1.6 billion.
I guess I don't even recognize a pharmaceutical industry in Wisconsin, Katie. So from the eyes of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, where is this industry coming from in the state?
Well, there are a number of key players in the state. I would say Merck Sigma Aldrich would be one of the key players in that industry.
And yet pharmaceuticals at almost $2 billion in exports in 2021, not at the top of the list of the goods that Wisconsin exported that year. What do we find, at least in a dollar value, that was greater than pharmaceuticals exporting out of Wisconsin?
There are actually quite a few things. So when you think about Wisconsin and its key industries, most people would think about agriculture and manufactured goods. So our top export categories are industrial machinery, medical and scientific instruments, electrical machinery, and then rounding out the fourth position is pharmaceutical products. So if you look at our number one export category, industrial machinery, we exported $5.7 billion, which is 9% over 2021, in 2021. And our top categories are transmission shafts and gears, internal combustion engines, as we make many, many precision combustion engines, and harvesting equipment. And 20% of those products actually go to Canada. And we saw the largest increase in that category in harvesting equipment. So our number two category, medical and scientific instruments, with exports of $2.2 billion, grew by 7%. And our top categories in that are X-ray equipment and electronic diagnostic equipment. And we saw double-digit increases in our top three export destinations. So China increased its purchases by 23%, Canada increased, Mexico increased, and then rounding it out with our electrical machinery, our third largest export category at $188 million, it grew by 5%. I think what's important to note, though, Lee, is that listeners may be surprised that in those top four categories, including the pharmaceutical products, you didn't hear about ag products, right?
I was just wondering about that.
Right? So let me cover that real briefly.
Yeah.
So agriculture products are interspersed in many, many different NAICS codes, which is a professional term of how we categorize products. But if you look at them as one super category, Wisconsin exports of food, forestry, and agricultural products reached an all-time high of almost $4 billion in 2021. And that's an 18% increase. And this super category is Wisconsin's second largest export category.
Behind industrial machinery?
Exactly.
Katie Sinnott is our guest, Vice President of Global Trade and Investment for the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, as we are looking at the increase in exports from Wisconsin overseas and with our trading partners in a continent with Canada and Mexico. And what would you like to know about Wisconsin's role in the global economy? And do you import export products for Wisconsin? And be interested in your experience this morning at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. And Katie, is this just a bounce back from the pandemic year of 2020, or if we go back a few years, are we still seeing that sort of trajectory of growth of exports from Wisconsin?
For the last few years, we have seen increase in our exports, but I think part of this really significant jump in exports and imports too is due to a pent-up demand from COVID-19.
And give us some idea of the role that the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, or the WEDC, plays in assisting businesses, opening new markets, and expanding Wisconsin's exports.
Sure, I would love to do that. One thing that always surprises me as I move around the state to talk about exporting and increasing your expertise in exporting is that our programs are not widely known. So I really appreciate that you're bringing us on the show today. So we have four key programs that will help exporters accelerate their export efforts. So we start off with a program called Export Tech, which is a C-suite designated program that allows those groups of people to design their export strategy. So over 3 8-hour sessions, they will create their export strategy, design their budget, create their elevator pitch, identify their target countries. And what we have found with Export Tech is that companies who have gone through this program, 12 months after their graduation, they have on average impact to their revenue of $1 million. And typically these are small to medium sized companies that are participating in this program. So it's a significant increase.
8 hours over 3 days, and the net result generally is about $1 million in additional revenue.
Right. It's actually over 3 months because they have a lot of homework in between right. each of those 8-hour sessions. It's a pretty intensive program. And, you know, one of the great things that came out of COVID, there are a few, but one of the things is the virtual aspect. So now Export Tech is largely virtual. So it's easier for companies around the state to participate in that program.
The second one.
Yeah, trade ventures. So it's always important to get your boots on the ground, get to know the country, see who your competitors are, see how your program or your products are offered in that country. During COVID, we pivoted very quickly to virtual trade ventures, which is something very new to all of us. So we offer trade ventures both virtually due to COVID, and now in fiscal 23, we'll be going back to in-person trade ventures. And what that will allow you to do is we'll take you in country, set up personalized meeting schedules based upon your own objectives for that country. We will set up hotels, we'll provide interpreters if required. All you need to do is show up ready to talk about your business.
Mm.
Go ahead.
Well, I want to take a break here if I can, Katie, but we're halfway through the list of four detailed ways that the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation is working with businesses across Wisconsin to expand exports. And as we see from the bottom line and the big picture numbers this morning, that number continues to grow. We'll take your questions at 1-800-642-1234, your comments about our role in the global markets. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Almost $25 billion in a year-to-year growth rate greater than 20%. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and that's the big picture and the broadest strokes of Wisconsin's exports in 2021. And we're getting granular with our guest and invite you to share how you see Wisconsin's place in the global economy and where our state's industries are heading from here. 1-800-642-1234 to join us. Our guest, Katie Sinnott. She's Vice President of Global Trade and Investment for the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. And we're mentioning the four programs available for businesses in Wisconsin to expand their exports. It began with Export Tech, a C-suite of three classes, 8 hours, but a lot of homework, and Trade Ventures were the second one. And Katie, what's the difference between a trade venture and a trade mission?
So a trade mission in Wisconsin indicates that the governor is present with us.
We'll get to the governor in a moment, but those were the first two programs available. What were the last two, Katie?
So the third one is our trade representative network. The trade representatives help us set up those trade ventures. They do many different things for our Wisconsin companies. They can do market assessments for a company. For example, let's say you received an inquiry about buying one of your big fire trucks from a country, and you weren't sure whether you should sell that fire truck to that country, you could do a market assessment of the country and understand better what your possibility for sales are in that country. They also do partner searches and one-off projects. One great example that is just really wild to me that one of our trade representatives helped with recently is we had a $1 million piece of equipment, not we, but one of our clients, and it was already on the ocean going to Australia. And the Australian import laws changed while that piece of equipment was sitting on the ocean.
Oh, no.
Right? So we worked with our Australian trade rep to get them an exemption so that they could actually offload that product in the port and get it to their client in Australia and get paid. Had they not worked through our trade representative, it would have been much more difficult when they landed in the port of Australia. So keep in mind the trade representative network that we have available for you. In addition, there's a help desk. So if you're just curious about tax rates, import duties, different things like that, those are free of charge services to Wisconsin companies. The last item would be grants. Grants always garner a lot of interest. We offer grants of between up to $25,000. If you're an Export Tech graduate, you will have access to up to $25,000. If you are not, you have access to $10,000. And the reason we gate those grants is we believe in the power of the Export Tech program to create a very good export strategy for companies.
Vice President of Global Trade and Investment for the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, or the WEDC, Katie Sinnott. I'm curious about what businesses have. What are the requirements for businesses to be able to participate in these programs that the WEDC offers, Katie?
Well, we certainly look for export readiness. So we would do an interview with the company to understand how prepared they are to go ahead and export. There's a set of questions that we ask. And then based upon that, we would work with them if we feel that they are export ready. And for example, with the grants program, we would help them set up a budget. So they would need to provide us with a budget of how they're going to use that program and what categories of expenses they would like to have reimbursed through that program. And they would have to be export-related expenses, for example, export education or trade shows. Happily, trade shows are restarting now, so people can go to other countries and participate in those trade shows. Different things like that.
And Katie, we've seen some stories of supply chain bottlenecks hindering imports and exports all over the world. Has Wisconsin seen the same?
Right. You know, supply chains have been a challenge, I must say. If you didn't realize how important your import-export manager is, or your supply chain manager, you do today. That person is now a rock star. So when you, it's important to understand that supply chain is like an umbrella term that includes a lot of factors. COVID, workforce challenges, natural disasters, as well as transportation. You know, all supply challenges have been really heavily impacted by COVID, as you know. But there are three things happening today with supply chains. So low cost is no longer king. Cost is now only one consideration. Businesses are looking for reliability of their supply chain. Can you supply the materials over time? And what kind of backups are there in the event of complications like COVID? We're also seeing a regionalization of supply chains. Single sourcing really is over. China remains a popular supplier, but companies are looking elsewhere in Asia, particularly in Southeast Asia, or they might even be regionalizing in different continents based upon where their customer base is. Additionally, as I said, the position of import and export and supply chain has really been elevated to the C-suite. So there's really increased scrutiny there. So it's no longer just a matter for the bottom line of where we get our supplies. It's no longer the lowest price, but it has to fit into a strategic consideration of what does the company need, how fast, how reliable, what's the risk in that supply chain.
Katie Sinnott, Vice President of Global Trade and Investment for the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, taking your questions at 1-800-642-1234. And Katie, just last week, Governor Evers signed a bill into law that intends to boost the state's dairy exports by 25% by 2026. That sounds like a daunting task. So how does the WEDC go into action when they get the call from the governor like that?
Well, the great thing about that is we have two great international teams working on that project. And we're so delighted that there is additional funding being provided for the export of crops, dairy, and meat products that will be largely managed through the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection by the excellent international team there. But we work as a great partnership together. Part of the funds will be through WEDC, through our International Market Access Grant Program, which I previously discussed. So rather than recreating the wheel, DATCAP, as we call them, and WEDC will work together to get the International Market Access Grant out to individual companies falling in those categories.
And so as you go through just this one example of expanding dairy exports, or the goal from the governor to expand dairy exports, what should dairy producers be thinking about? What role will they play in this, and how can they access an opportunity to gain international markets?
Well, I think their first stop would be to talk to the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection international team for them to understand what the dairy producer would like to do. Typically, they would be selling their product to someone who would be exporting it. It's typically not the dairy producer. It's the food producer further down the supply chain. So they could talk to the team there, or they could talk to us. You could contact me at katy.sinnott@wedc.org.
That's WEDC.org. That's all right. Yeah. Katie.Sinnott@WEDC.org. And Katie, if you were to look into your crystal ball and see the future of the Wisconsin economic development and the future of global markets and the opportunities that Wisconsin businesses have, what do you see?
Well, we have the January export numbers, and they look promising. We exported in January $2.1 billion, an increase again of 13% over 2021. So the future looks bright. Our manufacturers are working well. The economy is robust based upon the bounce back of our export numbers.
Yeah, and it's fascinating to see the systems at work in Wisconsin's economy. So, Katie, thank you so much for sharing it with us this morning.
Thank you.
Katie Sinnott, Vice President of Global Trade and Investment for the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. Up next is news. Then we're going to hear from a graduate student who's inside Russia right now about what they are seeing on the ground during this historic moment. Also want to remind you, on Monday at this time, after the 7 o'clock news, we've got your state capitol report in the 7 o'clock hour on Monday, and we'll be speaking with Wisconsin's Attorney General Josh Call. We plan to ask him the latest on the state's PFAS lawsuits, what's happening with tribal rights for fishing with spears, and recent opioid settlement funds, and what the state will do with that. Also, the Attorney General will be answering your questions Monday morning. That'll be after the 7 o'clock news. You're welcome to join us for the full hour of the State Capitol Report. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent. And our next guest joins us live from St. Petersburg, Russia. What do you want to know about what's happening there right now? What questions do you have about how the Russian people are reacting to their government's decision to invade Ukraine? 1-800-642-1234 is your chance to ask our guest your questions, or email them quick, ideas@wpr.org. Joining us this morning goes by Mac. He's a Wisconsin native and a graduate of a Wisconsin university where he double majored in sociology and Russian and minored in Russian and Eastern European studies. He is currently a graduate student in St. Petersburg. Mac, thank you for joining us this morning.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
I just want to know from you what the Russians know about what is happening in Ukraine. How would you describe what the Russians know about what's happening in Ukraine?
Mm-hmm. Well, the first thing I would say is it's important to keep in mind that there is no sort of monolith that is like all of Russians, right? There are various types of Russians, various social groups. People consume information, they consume their news differently. And so some people are getting information from state media. That's what we usually call state propaganda. There are some people that are getting information from independent news online. There are some people getting information from their friends through various channels on the application, the messaging application Telegram. And so if we keep that in mind, keeping in mind that people are getting different types of information from different sources, then we can say that there are sort of like two major groups. There's the group of people that are getting information from the state media, and then there are people getting information from more independent sources, and that group tends to be smaller.
And I get that. I think most folks can, media consumers in the States would be able to appreciate and understand that the different outlets would provide different information, which could lead different people to different conclusions. But those consuming the state media would be a larger portion at this point. And so the U.S. State Department, I got to ask you this, is urging Americans in Russia to leave the country immediately. Is this something you've considered, Mac?
It's definitely something I keep in mind every day. This is, it's always a concern in Russia, but especially right now, just being an American citizen in Russia. The State Department, from what I understand, has been making this sort of recommendation for the past month, but now they sort of have reiterated that recommendation and they're sort of being more insistent now. It's always something to, to be thinking about. I right now personally do not feel that I'm in any sort of danger. I don't feel that I'm being threatened. The red line that I've sort of drawn for myself personally for when I, understand that I need to grab my suitcase and leave is when the Russian government starts to sort of indiscriminately target foreign citizens, specifically Americans. And usually they go after not, students like me first, they go after people like journalists, business people. So there's sort of this hierarchy of who they might go after first. And obviously there was the case of the basketball player, the American basketball player who was arrested a few weeks ago. And of course, you know, if you're somebody who's already in the, you know, spotlight, if you're you have some sort of public image, then that makes you a bigger target. So I'm sort of keeping close eye on what's happening in the news. I still don't see that indiscriminate targeting of Americans wholesale. So at the moment, I don't feel that it's critical that I leave. But again, always, you know, just keeping an eye out.
Good to hear. Our guest is going by Mac, a graduate of Wisconsin University, now pursuing a master's degree at a university in Russia. He joins us this morning from St. Petersburg and taking your questions at 1-800-642-1234. You know other Americans over there right now, Mac?
I do know a couple of Americans. There's actually one man here, Bob, that I know. He's an elderly man, and he's elderly, but he's very physical. He's a dancer. He's been dancing his whole life, and he's been coming to St. Petersburg for the past, I think for the past 2 decades or so. And he goes to the gym where I, you know, go, you know, on a regular basis, and him and I talk, and he has sort of the same mood that I have, in terms of, you know, when we'll start to, you know, head out the door, how safe we feel at the moment. So I know Bob, but other than Bob, currently I don't know any Americans in Russia. There was one American, a student in my program that left quite early once this situation started. And I'm in contact with him. He's in Europe from what I understand right now.
Mac, what's a day in the life like for you right now in Russia? Just give us some idea of, is it feel normal? Is it different? I mean, you've had, a better part of 4 years there almost?
Almost 4 years, yeah.
Yeah, so what's life like there now, and how do you compare it to your, the rest of your experience in Russia?
Well, things here on the ground, on a very superficial level, do not seem to have changed that much in terms of the general mood, in terms of the general atmosphere among people. We're starting to see things like inflation definitely is starting to creep up. Prices of goods are rising. Some goods are missing from stores. Sugar is one thing that's missing on a lot of store shelves, though the supermarket closest to my apartment, they have plenty of sugar. So it seems to be a logistical problem more so than Russia not having enough sugar. We're definitely seeing a lot more examples, a lot more patriotic symbols in public spaces. I'm seeing Russian flags or on streets more often than I did before, just because unlike the United States, for example, where you see American flags everywhere, in Russia, unless it's a holiday, you don't really see Russian flags everywhere. And now we're seeing them, you know, hung up everywhere. We're also seeing that Z symbol that has sort of become this symbol, this pro-regime symbol here in Russia, that is visible in public places. Sometimes you might see somebody driving their car with the, you know, Z made out of duct tape on their window. And among my friends, obviously the mood has sort of become quite negative, though people now after a month are trying to sort of get back to some semblance of a normal life. But if you just walk out to the street and take things in on a very superficial level, it really doesn't seem that the mood has changed all that much. Things are, it's kind of strange. Some things have changed, some things haven't.
Mac, do others know that you're an American in St. Petersburg right now? Do they ask you about your perspective as an American?
My friends ask me, some of my acquaintances ask me, and it's more not really them trying to get an idea of what my, you know, my perspective is on the situation, more of them asking, you know, Mac, are you planning on leaving, or are you planning on staying, things like that. Obviously a lot of my friends and family in the United States are very concerned, you know, for me. And I try to insist that, you know, I'm aware of what's going on. Whereas my friends here in Russia sort of, you know, they understand me because they see that the situation here on the ground, at least, has not changed too much. Of course, that could all, you know, in a matter of days and weeks, become dramatically different. But as of now, things are more or less as they were before. But, I if we're just talking about people who don't know me personally, haven't met me, I sort of blend in with the crowd. I could seem like a Russian. They speak Russian fluently. So it's not as though people are able to identify me out, you know, on the street or if I'm in the shop, you know, as an American. So in that regard, yeah, no.
Let me ask you how people in Russia are discussing what's happening in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, this depends on what group we're talking about. If we're going to talk about my friends who are sort of against what's happening in Ukraine right now, we're to talk about more sort of liberal leaning Russians, and obviously they're discussing what's happening all the time, every day. It's the only topic of discussion at this point among those sorts of people. And that's what me and my friends, me and my acquaintances discuss all the time. If we're to talk about just sort of, you know, ordinary Russians who aren't really tuned into the news, who try to stay out of politics for the most part, which is a very, I would say, large number of Russians, then they're discussing probably the same things that they discussed before. Now they have the new topic of, you know, price inflation, some Western brands leaving Russia, or some, you know, Western companies temporarily suspending operations in Russia. That's definitely something you really can't avoid, even if you try to stay out of politics. And then there are, you know, of course, those who are sort of plugged into this narrative that the Russian state is pushing. They're, you know, in support of what is being termed a, you know, special operation here in Russia. And they discuss, obviously, the situation from their point of view. So it's really hard to say, like, again, what Russians in general are saying. It's always going to depend on, you know, what information they're consuming, what sort of social group they belong to, what sort of political leanings they have.
Would you say they're, generally speaking, a generational gap?
Definitely. There's definitely a generational gap, I would say, because even if, you know, just take anecdotal evidence that I have, you know, obtained from talking with my friends, there always seems to be this conflict between parents and children. All of my friends who are of my generation or who are millennials are pretty much on the same page in terms of, you know, how they feel about what's going on in Ukraine, how they feel about the Russian government. And they're always telling me how they're getting into these very heated arguments with their parents about what's happening, why is it happening, whose side should be supported or whose side they're on or not on. So there definitely does seem to be a generational gap. There are, of course, exceptions, but I would say by and large, there is a significant gap between generations of how they view the situation.
Our guest goes by Mac. He's a Wisconsin native and graduate of Wisconsin University, where he double majored in sociology and Russian, minored in Russian and Eastern European studies. He's currently a graduate student at a university in St. Petersburg, where he joins us this morning and is answering our questions. You can join the conversation, 1-800-642-1234. Get your emails in now, ideas@WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn, and this is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Thanks to our guest. This is just an incredible opportunity for us. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we are talking to an American student in St. Petersburg, Russia. He's heard the warnings, and we want his safety to be paramount here. We also want to know what's happening there, what Russians know, what they think, and perhaps what we can expect next. So what questions do you have for our guest, who goes by Mac? 1-800-642-1234. And Mac, you mentioned before, and something I'd heard and from here in the States, about the special operations being referred to in Ukraine when you're in Russia. Is it being reinforced that this is a short-term operation, what's happening in Ukraine? Or do Russians get the general sense that this is a long, hard slog, or that this will be over momentarily?
I would say that a lot of people here in Russia are sort of bullish about the situation. They are sort of expecting that this is going to end within the next month or two. And so, you know, this sort of is influencing their expectations on when Western companies might, you know, come back to Russia, when they might, you know, have their operations resume. And so even among people who are sort of pessimistic about the situation in general, they're not so pessimistic that they think this is going to last. let's say, until the end of the year or even years and years. And I mean, many people think this is going to end soon.
Reuters reported in early March that Russian authorities had arrested more than 4,300 people for protesting the Ukraine conflict. Do you see protests? Are they continuing? Have you seen arrests? What's on the streets?
There were protests when this all began. But over the past couple of weeks, after thousands of people were protested, after the government came cracking down on these protests, they've sort of died down. The problem is that there's really no sort of infrastructure, protest infrastructure, I would call it, that is able to mobilize people in Russia at this point in opposition to what the government is doing in Ukraine. Obviously, there are people who would like to express their opposition in some way or another, but they don't know how to do that. And there's no network there. There's no way to sort of mobilize masses of people. And so this is really what we've seen happen over the past couple of weeks. Activists being arrested as soon as they leave their home sometimes. People who even before weren't really big players in the opposition movement in Russia, sort of local level activists, have been targeted in the past month. And obviously the biggest opposition activists and politicians in Russia over the past several years have been arrested, have been forced to flee Russia in exile. So now they're sort of moving down the chain and targeting these sort of local, smaller players, and it's made it very difficult to do any sort of protests on a large scale.
And, you know, I would think, well, we've got all these social media networks, and why aren't those able to be utilized for organizing?
They can be utilized, but the thing is, for a protest to really sort of maintain its momentum, you need more than just, a social messaging app to, you know, tell people to go meet at this location or another. You need faces of the protest movement. And that's one of the things that's lacking right now. There's no sort of, fiery personality that's encouraging people to go out to the streets to protest. And so that's one thing that's lacking. Another thing too is people are, frankly, here in Russia, they're scared. They see how the police crack down on people who go and attend rallies. They see how the police mistreat them. And so this has sort of terrified many people into basically not going out to protest. And on top of that, again, you don't have this network. So it's just a bunch of factors sort of coupled together that is really preventing any sort of mass protest movement from happening right now.
And when you explain it for us, Mac, it doesn't sound so foreign. It sounds in many ways, in many aspects, things that we can relate to here in the States. So I want to thank you so much for sharing your experiences in St. Petersburg with us this morning. Please stay safe, and I hope we have this opportunity to talk again, Mac. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Our guest goes by Mac, Wisconsin native, graduate of Wisconsin University, where he double majored in sociology and Russian, minored in Russian and Eastern European studies. He's currently a graduate student, and he joined us live in St. Petersburg this morning. Now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Giannis Antetokounmpo just became the Bucks' all-time scoring leader last night in an overtime win against Brooklyn. With that in mind, here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a new anthem for Wisconsin sports fans.
When the Milwaukee Bucks won their first NBA title in 50 years last year, Milwaukee hip-hop artist Romy was courtside. As a lifelong Bucks fan, the moment was not just a thrill, but inspiring. He recently talked with WPR's Jenny Peake about how that experience led to his hit song, Fear the Deer.
Growing up, Jerome Hunt got to see his dad compete against countless Milwaukee Bucks players. Hunt would watch the one-on-one basketball games go down at Milwaukee's Martin Luther King Jr. Community Center, where his dad was the recreation director.
They had the semi-pro league called the NBA Pro-Am. And so there, that was my first experience at getting around professional athletes, Bucks players. They were looking to get a good run, and I just got to be up close and personal, got to be the water boy. And that was when I pretty much fell in love with it.
He remembers the 1988 grand opening ribbon-cutting ceremony at the Bradley Center, and when the Bucks selected Glenn Big Dog Robinson as the 1994 number one overall draft pick.
With the first pick in the 1994 NBA draft, the Milwaukee Bucks select Glenn Robinson from Purdue University.
Time and time again, Hunt fell in love with the Bucks.
The same sort of thing kind of happened when they drafted Giannis, and there was another like huge resurgence.
A resurgence that led the team to their first NBA title since 1971.
It's over. The Bucks have done it. The long wait has ended. After a half century, the Milwaukee Bucks are NBA champions once again.
A victory that Hunt, who goes by the stage name Romy, is still basking in.
It meant everything, every kind of valley and peak of the team. You know, I felt like the sixth man. I was just right there, just being inspired by the team.
Bringing home the championship sent a spark of creativity through Romy, a veteran Milwaukee hip-hop artist. Standing courtside after the win, the lyrics to his hit song, Fear the Deer, unraveled before his eyes.
Do it for the city, yep. Do it for the haters. Do it like Kareem before he went to be a Laker. Yes. 50 years later.
I just went into grind mode, just full, like, I need to capture this. This inspiration and this type of me coming to all these Bucks games since I was a kid and all this culminating into this moment, I had to capture that. And Fear the Deer is that.
Fear the deer, fear the deer. We the Bucks, we the champs, this our year.
Some of Romy's favorite lyrics in the song look to the future instead of just reflecting on last year's glory.
I like the repeat is our move. Greek Freak is that dude.
And like you said in that interview, we can play with our food. We gon' ride or die for our team, whether we win or whether we lose. I be in the front row, lit like Bakhtiari chugging them brews, man.
I like that because repeat is our mood. And so I wanted to put it in there just to kind of just put it on people's mentals that we have some more winning to do.
Fear the deer, fear the deer, in the deer district, yeah, we chugging beer.
And he's feeling pretty good about the Bucks' chances this season.
We go as far as Giannis, K-Mid, and Drew takes us. And just getting Splash Mountain finally back. Just seeing Brook Lopez out there to finish the season up to really get back in shape just in time for the playoffs. That was a much-needed addition. We're the champs until somebody beats us. And so that's going to be the mood. That's going to be the mentality.
And Romy will have the chance to deliver that energy on the court at halftime during the Bucks' final home game of the season on April 7th.
When you love music as much as I do, that joy and that passion and that love, when it's reciprocated from the fans and from the listeners, that never gets old.
Would you rip that rock? Started up the fast break. Break. 120 on the clock.
WPR's Jenny Peek brought us that story on Milwaukee artist Romy and his new song, Fear the Deer. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum, Bucks in Six.
All right, she's not wrong. I mean, the Bucks are a half game out of first in the Eastern Conference right now, so we'll agree with that. Join us Monday morning after 7:30 on the Ideas Network and meet the new executive director of the Wisconsin ACLU, Melinda Brennan. She's born and raised in Port Washington. We'll find out where she plans to lead the organization
next. Celebrate the